It looks like most people are in, so we can start this morning's talk. And I'm going to start by just reading out some of the questions on meditation from last night, and then afterwards I'll start the talk proper. So, first question I have here on meditation was, I noticed that sometimes chants or tunes keep ringing in my mind, especially during the morning sitting. What do I do? And thank you very much. It's sometimes the reason why they are tunes or chants, why they are very popular, is because they do tend to stick in the mind. So it's very, very difficult, because once they start, it's very hard to get them out of the mind. So the only real way to do it is do some sort of substitution. So in other words, instead of listening to the song in your head, maybe just start to experience the feelings in the body. And the feelings in the body should be pretty strong and be able to supplant the tunes in the head. So you just turn to something else. And if you turn long enough to something else, like feelings in the body, then the tunes in the head, not getting any attention, they will stop. If that doesn't work, a very, very effective way, if you have the courage to do this, is in the middle of the hall here, start singing the tune in front of everybody. That will make you so embarrassed you'll soon never do it again. But I know you wouldn't be able to do that. So just try some little substitution. The next question, again, four questions here. Dear Ajahn Brahm, with so many views from various schools in Buddhism, it is easy to get confused. Don't all these teachers from all schools agree that one should follow the suttas? Is reading and interpreting the suttas on one's own sufficient to set one on the correct journey of the path? I am quite wary of opinions, especially from older folks with good intentions, trying to set the young ones on the correct way or path. Uh-oh, I'm one of the older folks now. I'm getting old. But no, it's very good to read the suttas. These days there are very good translations. And read them for yourselves, because if someone else interprets them for you, they can interpret them in their particular way. So those suttas, there's enough of them, and the Buddha repeats himself so many times that it's very difficult to miss the message which he is giving. So I say, yeah, read the suttas, they're very good. And you don't really need a teacher, because you have the suttas, you can read them again and again and again and again, and after a while you get the message. But when it says various views from various schools, somebody asked me this a couple of days ago, and it's a very good question, and the answer I think is important for you. They say, should we only follow one particular teacher in meditation? Should you be addicted to Ajahn Brahm and nobody else? And the answer is obviously no, because even if you were at school or university saying you were studying chemistry, you didn't have one lecturer, you had many, many lecturers in different aspects of chemistry. And the reason was that one lecturer will be very strong in one part and weak in others, and by having many lecturers, their combined wisdom would give you a very, very good understanding of, say, chemistry. In the same way, and so by doing that, by having several teachers, things which I'm very strong in, you can benefit from where I'm weak and another teacher is strong, then that will complement. So wherever you find a good teacher, and they're saying good things, then fine. But the sort of teachers I would be very wary of is ones who say, follow my method, because my method is the only method. All other teachers are wrong. I'm the only one who knows what Buddhism is. And to me that sounds very suspicious. So even the Buddha didn't do that. The Buddha said, oh, go and talk to Sariputta, go and talk to Moggallana, go and talk to Mahakasapa. So anyone who says that my way is the only way and all other ways aren't, that is very suspicious. Don't follow such con men, or con monks, or con nuns, or whatever. Anyway, what should I do if I lost the breath in the midst of meditation, or the breath becomes not clear? There is a tendency to control the breath, or boredom arises, and then restlessness, which brings on the desire to stop meditating, get up and do walking meditation. The same happened when I tried making peace and being gentle. Should I apply some discipline here, or should I give in? Sometimes it depends when the breath disappears in meditation. Now there is a natural time when the breath gets so calm and so subtle that you lose awareness of the breath. The breath is still there, but it's subtle and your mindfulness is not strong enough to notice it. And then it's just keep on watching. You know you're breathing and you haven't died yet, so you are breathing. So it means that you are not watching where it actually is. Sometimes this occurs when people watch the breath at the tip of the nose and the breath is happening somewhere else. So if you watch it here but it's over there, of course you won't watch it. So again, try and watch the breath where it happens to manifest. And don't choose where it manifests. Keep it natural. The breath will manifest in your body at different places at different times. So your job is to know the breath where it is, rather than always expect it to be in one place. And that's one of the great ways of losing the breath. You expect it to be somewhere, but it's somewhere else, therefore you can't find it. So, but if the breath does become not clear, the best thing to do is just stay there. Say, what am I aware of? Because in every moment you're aware of something. So what is it I'm aware of when the breath disappears? And investigate that. And your mindfulness will become sharper and more powerful. It's being trained on more subtle objects. It's a tougher test, but it's one worthwhile doing, to see what you're aware of when the breath disappears and stay with that. Then it's not boring at all, it becomes incredibly fascinating, and it means you haven't lost anything, because the breath has gone but another object has arisen which is far more interesting. But the subject of the talk afterwards, when I finish these questions, will be actually talking about breath meditation, so hopefully it will also be covered again in a few minutes. 3. Can one change the object of meditation? How long should one stay with the new subject? Wouldn't it be chaotic and non-systematic if we do so? Can one do metta halfway through meditating, say using mindfulness of the breath? How long should one keep doing metta meditation? Yeah, life is chaotic. So that's the nature of life. So, you know, this morning the breakfast never came on time. That's chaos. It's the nature of things. Sometimes it rains when it's not supposed to rain. It shines when it's not supposed to shine. So life is chaotic. Life is out of control. So relax. You try and make it different and you just get tense. So, change the object of meditation. Yeah, of course you can. And a wise person does that. Years ago I gave the simile of a carpenter. So a carpenter's making, say, a chest of drawers. And he gets some wood from the shop. And he doesn't always use the same tool. Yeah, first of all you use the saw, and when the saw has done its job, then you use a plane. When you've planed the wood, then you use sandpaper, and you use different grades of sandpaper. When you've done the finest sandpaper, then you use a polishing cloth. The same in meditation, there's different tools for different times. So if you often find your mind is just very sort of angry or just fed up, then you do metta meditation. May all beings, may my breath, may me be happy and well. Even though I'm a stupid meditator, I still love me. And then when you do loving kindness to yourself, oh, you really relax and meditation gets very, very easy. Or sometimes you may just have lust or something. You may be sitting next to a very beautiful girl and think, oh, does she like me? Oh, I'm not supposed to be thinking of that. I'm on retreat, but she's very nice. Then you do sort of some of the asupa meditations. Like you look at the, say, the five parts of the body. Hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. Because you know the hair of the body is all dead. Because the roots are actually under the skin. You can't see the roots, the live part of hair. So hair of the head and hair of the body, if you look at the people's hair here, all you see is dead matter. The live part of the roots is under the skin. Nails and teeth are the same. No, that's dead. That's dead. The root is unseen. And even the skin, what you actually see in the skin again is dead. The live part of the skin is maybe a millimetre or two underneath. So all this which you see on the outside is dead. So if there's any boys here who are looking at the girls and think, wow, she's nice. What do you mean she's nice? All you see is dead hair, dead skin, dead teeth and dead nails. Just dead matter, it's a corpse. And why would you like to stroke a dead hair? Ugh, yuck, that's sick. So that's just like doing a super meditation to get rid of your lust. So sometimes we do different meditations for different things, and it's quite okay to do that. Later on, and again this becomes part of the talk here, the meditation becomes automatic. The mind just changes the tools to fit the situation. And you don't make the choice at all, it just happens. So, yes, you can change the object of meditation. As coming up in the best meditation, the objects change naturally, and there's a good reason for that. But that's coming soon. And number four, I had many painful periods in my life, and a few months ago I had my dengue fever number two. Does everyone have to have dengue fever? So this is number two. As if like you had my dengue fever, like you had your O-levels and A-levels. But no, it's just a bit of bad luck there. After 7 to 10 days of intense pain, which I tried meditating on whenever I could, I had this feeling of not caring whether I die or not, about others and their feelings, about the future and the goings-on of the world. This lasted until I regained my craving and clinging. Please can you share your thoughts about this? Would it be wonderful if you got rid of your dengue fever and never took up your craving and clinging again? But never mind. At least when you had that sort of pain, that dominated the whole of your consciousness because it demanded your full attention. But the next time, if that does happen, hopefully it doesn't happen, whenever there's pain there, please remember there's two parts of the pain. There's the physical pain and the mental pain. The physical pain is the stuff you can't really do anything about because, you know, it's part of the nature of the body to hurt, to ache, and to be sometimes in intense pain. But the mental part of it is, I don't want this, I can't stand this. Now that's the thing which one can work on during painful periods of your life. And especially it helps a lot to stay in the present moment, because a lot of the agony of pain, the torture of pain, is that how long is this going to last for? And I can't stand this any longer. If you can train yourself in present moment awareness on this retreat, then whenever there is great agony or pain in your life, if you can come into the present moment, it's far easier to deal with, because the pain is here now, you're dealing with this now. And it's the fear of what's going to happen next. That's the terror of pain. And if one never has any expectation, one stays in the present moment with the pain, it's not that hard to bear, no matter how extreme it is. So the next time you have this, see if you can use your meditation, get in the present moment, and you'll find this incredible amount of things you can do with extreme pain. And that's why that many people in pain clinics learn meditation, learn these techniques, because it really helps enormously deal with the problem, much better than drugs do. During meditation, my mind often wanders off. I told myself to stop thinking and brought my attention back to the present moment. The same process keeps repeating. To progress in this stage, should I observe the gap between thoughts, wagger the silence between them, thank you very much. Yeah, this is, again, a common problem when people start meditating, their mind wanders off. And I often thought, why does the mind wander off anyway? And it must be because it's not happy where it already is. So if it really is happy where you are, then of course you don't wander off at all. So somehow we need to put some happiness, some contentment, some joy into where we already are. And to do that, all it really needs is a marketing campaign by you. To market your experience right now. Look, here I'm in this present moment, I'm in this room. It's a wonderful, I've been wanting to come on this retreat, I've been planning it for years, I had to go through so many hoops to actually get here, ask permission from my husband, my wife, my boss at work, and actually register and get in here. Now I'm here. Now I'm wandering off and doing other things. It's a real stupid thing to do. So you convince yourself it's good to be here. And you also convince yourself that if you continue to put your attention on this moment and on the breath, whatever it is, and don't wander off, you're going to get great rewards. You're going to get Ajahn Brahm's bliss better than sex. You're going to see all these incredible lights. You're going to sort of be able to float through the air. You're going to be able to remember your past lives. You're going to actually understand some of the Dhamma. You may even get enlightened in this very life. That's all there for you. And if you don't get enlightened in this life, you're going to have to come back again. You're going to have to go to school all over again. You're going to have to wear nappies, and every time you want something, your mum's going to stick this dummy in your mouth, a pacifier again. Do you really want to go through that all over again? So you better pay attention to the meditation. So in other words, you sort of give yourself a little commentary to convince yourself that it's important to stay in the present moment. But don't worry too much, because that's par for the course. After some training, you find you get more skillful. You don't wander off so much. You can catch your mind wandering off just before it goes. Say, no, come on, stay at home. And that way that you can not need to keep repeating the process. When practice mindfulness during the quiet moment, I can feel my mind in the outer world as sense of barrier in between them, There is an urge wanting to break the barrier. Is this feeling correct? Okay, so I think I understand. Now, the practicing mindfulness and during the quiet moments, they can feel the difference between the inner world and the outer world. And they want to break that barrier in between. And of course, it's good to. And the only way to break it is to put more attention, more interest in the inner world. And if your interest is in the inner world, then after a while the outer world totally disappears. So this is what happens in meditation. You're paying so much attention to the inner world, whether you're watching the breath or watching the body or whatever, and it becomes so interesting and fascinating, after a while the outer world just totally disappears and you haven't got a clue what other people are doing. And sometimes it happens, you're having such a good meditation, I ring the gong or I say it's time for breakfast, you don't even hear that and you carry on meditating. This is just quite natural. It means that the mind is paying so much attention to the inner world, the outer world is broken. It's a very good thing to do. So give it a try and see what happens. So that's some of the questions, because these are meditation questions. The other questions there, is it a meditation question? Another announcement. Okay, another announcement. Oh, you're going to be in trouble. The masking tape is coming out. Could you please remind the participants to keep the rule of noble silence, even in the dormitory? So, in fact, keep all the rules, and includes lights off after 10:30. What are you doing after 10:30? Are you chatting? Are you having discussions? Are you having midnight parties? I don't know. So remember, lights off at 10:30, and no talking, especially in the dormitories, because some people like to sleep, some people like to meditate, and you're not sleeping that much, so the time you have got to sleep is important. And if somebody's talking, the other people can't go to sleep. And listen when people do talk. Are they talking interesting stuff? No, it's all rubbish they talk. So please, be quiet. Although this is not a concentration camp, it is a community living together. So please take this opportunity to respect each other. Thank you very much, or else. No, they never said or else. So please remember, those people who have motor mouths, please keep them shut. Okay, now, the talk for this morning is actually on the Anapanasati, on the breath, because it is an important part of meditation, and it's an interesting teaching of the Buddha, and it's just sometimes what happens anyway. For example, if you follow the method which I've been describing so far, you just make peace, you're kind, you're gentle, you're just in this present moment, just here in this moment, all the past and all the future vanishes. And if you focus on this present moment, actually you soon go to that next stage of silence. There's nothing much to think about or to talk about, there's nothing much going on. You know, sometimes if you watch your thoughts, it's just like the commentary on a soap opera. It's just totally useless stuff. I don't know why people watch soap operas or watch these reality TV shows called Big Brother or Big... Have they got Big Sister yet? I don't know anyway, or Big Monk. So instead of having Big Brother or Big Sister or Big Monk, it's all rubbish stuff which people are interested in. And if you could actually record your thoughts and play them back to yourself, you'd be disgusted at the sort of stupid things which you think about, totally useless. So after a while, just quite naturally, one goes into a silence, because silence is holy, it's a sacred silence, it's really important, and after a while you recognize its value so much as a place where you can rest, where you can heal, where problems are solved in silence, not by more thoughts. So you just get into the silence. And so you're sitting there in this moment being silent. Now what happens naturally is that because you're silent, and because you're sitting still, because you've got your eyes closed, and because the people aren't sort of talking or moving around, there's basically nothing going on outside. There's nothing for the brain to attend to. So the brain will then attend to the only other thing which is happening, which is your breath going in and going out. When everything else calms down, that's the last thing which is moving, your breath. And so This is one of the reasons why the Buddha chose the breath meditation. Because when everything else, when the sense of sight turns off because you've closed your eyes, you can't see anything, when you're sitting in a reasonably quiet place, so there's nothing to listen to because no one's talking and there's no great sounds, when you're sitting still, so there's no feelings really going on in the body, and there's no tastes or smells, when the five senses are mostly calmed down, the one thing which you can't stop moving is your breathing. Which is why when everything else settles down, that's the last thing which remains, the breath. Which is why the Buddha said to focus on it. So even if you don't choose, the breath comes to you. And because I've been meditating for such a long time now, I never go looking for the breath. I sit down here, I close my eyes, I get into the present moment, stop all the thinking, just let it go, I'm not interested in it anymore. And then the breath comes up, all by itself. I don't choose it, it just comes. And the reason is because when everything else is gone, that is the only thing left. However, for those of you who want to nudge the process along a bit, you can actually choose to watch the breath. But remember, present moment awareness and silence first of all. Because if you start watching the breath too soon, you have to put so much effort to keep awareness on the breath. It just makes you tired, and you get stressed, and you get headache. The first time I came to Malaysia to teach meditation, people told me of a phenomena I'd never heard of before. I first heard this word in this country, Malaysia, in this city of Kuala Lumpur. It was called Samadhi headache. And I thought, what? Samadhi headache? Samadhi is peace and it's joy. You relax. Headache? What the heck have you guys been doing? And what you were doing, you was trying so hard. Breathing in, breathing out, I've got to watch the breath, breathing in, breathing out, I can't lose any breath, otherwise I get into trouble, breathing in, breathing out, or else. Now with that type of tension, you know, for half an hour or an hour, especially over 8 days, of course you'll get headache. You're trying far too hard. You're using willpower instead of wisdom power. And the great thing about the Buddha's teachings was to understand that wisdom is far more stronger than will. It's not effort, it's insight makes you peaceful. So you don't use wisdom power, you don't use willpower, you use wisdom power. So number one, if you can't hold the breath easily, it means you haven't done the preparation yet. You know, in all forms of life, if you're painting a wall, the preparation is 90% the contributor to a good paint job. If you're going to do an examination, it's a preparation which makes you succeed. If you're even playing in a soccer match, it's a preparation. You can't just attend the kickoff and then think you're going to do well. It's all the training in the gym and in the with the coach that makes you succeed well. Preparation is important. When people go onto the breath too soon without preparing themselves, they just can't hold it except through willpower, and then they get stressed and frustrated. Which is why for a long time I've really encouraged people to do a lot of loving kindness, a lot of being in the present moment, a lot of stillness, so that when they turn onto the breath, it's not that hard to watch. If you put your mind on the breath, first of all, why does the mind wander away anyway? Because it wanders off into the future or the past. You're still interested in planning what's going to happen next. You're still lingering on your history, what happened to you earlier on. It's this unfinished business which is still obsessing the mind. So you can't stay with the breath. If you're watching the breath and you wander off, where do you wander to? Past and future mostly. And the other place you wander off into is fantasies and dreams. That's because you're still thinking. The power of the mind to think has not been reduced. So you just can't stop the mind. You watch the breath, breathing in, breathing out, and you're thinking all over the place. Because you haven't really addressed the calming of thinking. So you have to start by addressing this tendency to run off into the past and future by doing present moment awareness, first of all. You have to address this tendency of your mind to get lost in thought by having silence first. And once you've cultivated not perfect present moment awareness, not perfect silence, but enough so the force of the mind to run off into the past or the future, the force of the mind to go thinking is heavily reduced. Reduced enough so that when you watch the breath, it's easy to watch. Not just breathing in, breathing out and getting lost, but be able to breathe in and out many, many times and watch 10, 20, 30 breaths easily without losing one. Which means that you know you are ready to do breath meditation. Try too soon and you get lost, and it's frustrating. So those of you who've done breath meditation haven't had much success yet. It's because you haven't done the preparation. You're not ready, you go onto the breath far too soon. Which is in the Anapanasati Sutta, which is where the Buddha said the first thing you do, even before you start the 16 stages, is to establish mindfulness, first of all. Now, establishing mindfulness is not an easy thing to do. Present moment awareness is the only place where mindfulness can exist. And again, not thinking. As I said yesterday, with a simile from Lao Tzu, you're either watching the words, beautiful sunset, or you're watching the sunset, and the two are very different. One is real mindfulness, when you just watch the sunset, and the other one, where you're just watching the words, not watching the true thing, it's not true mindfulness. So when you develop enough silence, and enough present moment awareness, you're ready to watch the breath. So then you do the first two stages, which the Buddha said, you know, being aware of the long breath, going in, going out, the short breath, going in, going out. And because people think these days, and they're rational, they say, what about the breath when it's not long and not short, but just in the middle somewhere? Have I lost the plot? Then no, it doesn't matter, long or short, it doesn't matter which one it is, or in between, or very long, or medium short, or sort of through two-thirds away. It doesn't matter, as long as you roughly know your breath is going in this amount and going out that amount. It's just something to make the breath interesting. Because when you first watch the breath, even though you've got silence and present moment awareness, you know, it's a bit boring at first. Watching the breath, I mean, you've got to spend the next 7 days watching my breath. That's boring, said the children. You mean that's all you do in the meditation retreat, watching the breath, going and watching the breath? I'd rather play computer games. I want to watch the movies. I want to go out. It's boring, they say. So you've got to make it interesting, first of all, which is why that sometimes they say a long breath or an in breath. So a long breath or an out, a long breath or a short breath or a medium breath or something. And it's this place that sometimes people do counting of the breaths. And there's all different ways of counting, but don't make it complicated. Because sometimes people make these complicated countings, which is great, which gives you something to do, but it just tires you because it's very hard. There's many, many ways of counting the breath, and I won't go into them here because you probably know plenty of them. Here we're just counting the breath, one in, one out, one in, two out, two, or whatever. So what that really does, it just keeps your attention sort of on the breath with something more to do. Other people use mantras at this stage. And the old mantra in the Thai forest tradition, as you breathe in, you recite the word Buddha, as you breathe out, Tho Buddho, the name of the Buddha. Breathing in, Buddha, breathing out, Tho Buddho, Buddho, Buddho. And that gives you something more to pay attention to as you watch the breath. In Australia, because it's not a Buddhist country, and the Australians, they just don't like just chanting Buddho along with the breath, so I give them another mantra to use. This is an Australian mantra. I say, as you breathe in, you have to recite to yourself, shut, as you breathe out, up. Shut, up, shut, up, shut, up. It's a very good mantra for the Australians, because they like that, because after telling themselves to shut up for a while, actually they do manage to shut up, which is quite an achievement for Australians. So you can make up your own mantra if you like. You know, sometimes people actually innovate, and they sometimes they breathing in peace, breathing out, letting go. Breathing in peace, breathe out, let go. Peace, let go. Peace, let go. So that these are not things which you have to do. but they give you an idea of the sort of mantras you can make up for yourself. You can design them for yourself. And when you do that, it means it's much easier to watch the breath when you have a little crutch, a little handle. So you're not just watching their breath going in and breath going out. You're giving something else to make it more interesting. And one of the other things which I have taught is that when you do breathe in, what actually are you breathing in? Where does this oxygen come from? The oxygen is a gift from all that's green in our world. It's a gift from the trees and the bushes and the plants of nature. So when you're breathing in, you're connecting with nature. And when you breathe out the carbon dioxide, that's what the plants take in, that's their food. So you breathe out your gift back to nature, the carbon dioxide. And so your breath is connecting you with all that is green and natural in this world. And if you're one of these greenies, that really gets you, and you think, wow, when I breathe in and breathe out, I'm actually making contact with those plants and trees outside. That's cool. It just makes it interesting. But if it's just breathing in, breathing out, that can be boring for many people. So you make it interesting. Other times I tell people it's just like watching the waves on the beach. If you like going down to the beach because it's a nice peaceful place, and you sit down on the rocks and you watch the waves come in and you watch the waves go back out again, the ebb and flow of the great ocean. And when you watch this breath, you're doing the same, this great atmosphere flowing into your nose like the waves up the beach and then receding away again as you breathe out. Just like watching the beach, the waves go in and go out. Ah, that's relaxing. And there's a good reason why it's relaxing. One of the other reasons I wonder, why is the breath such a good meditation object? And because, you know, I was always interested in psychology, I think there's a good reason to suspect it is because your earliest memories in this life, either in your mother's womb or afterwards breastfeeding on her tummy, that you got to know the rhythm of her chest rising and falling away. This very, very gentle rhythm of breath is something which psychologically you recognize from the earliest times of your existence in this life as being safe, warm, and loving. So you associate that rhythm as something very pleasant, which is why the gentle natural rhythm of the breath, the same rhythm you recognize deep in your subconscious as the rise and fall of your mother's tummy while you're in the womb or breastfeeding, is something which makes it very easy to be with. It's safe, it's soft, it's warm. Which is why the Buddha said that's a great time to start the breath, great place to start meditation with the breath. You're just being with the breath as it goes in and goes out, relaxing, warm, safe, with no anxiety. It's a very good meditation object. But of course I should say, where do you watch the breath? Please don't watch it at one particular place because you think that's where you should watch the breath. As I said yesterday or this morning or sometime or other, when you live in a timeless place, you don't remember what day it is. And if you watch it at the tip of the nose and it happens to be in your tummy, you can't find it. If you watch it in your tummy and it's at the tip of the nose, again you can't find it. Wherever your breath happens to be, that's where you watch it. So it's great when I have new meditators. New meditators, I tell them to close your eyes, breathe in and out 3 times, open your eyes, and I say, how do you know you're breathing in, breathing out? And they get quite confused. I just knew. Great, that's all you need to do. Because this is breath meditation. It's not nose meditation. It's not belly meditation. It's not throat meditation. It's breath meditation. You follow the breath, not your nose. And anyway, those people who focus on the tip of the nose, and you focus and focus and focus, you are likely to get samadhi headache. And you know the reason why. In this demonstration, you have to look at my eyes. I'm going to take my glasses off so you can see it very easily. When you usually meditate, you close your eyes, and if you watch the tip of your nose, something happens underneath your eyelids. But now I'm going to do the same thing with my eyes, lids open, so you can see what you do when you focus on the tip of the nose. Even though you're focusing your mind on the tip of your nose, everything goes on the tip of the nose as well. And if you spend about 1 hour doing this, going cross-eyed, no wonder you get samadhi headache above here. You've gone cross-eyed. You can't see it because your eyelids are closed. But this is what happens to you. So be very, very careful. Just watch the breath wherever it happens to be. And that way you'll find it's much easier to watch the breath. A lot of the times, quite naturally, it settles here. But sometimes it doesn't. So don't look for it here. Look for it wherever it happens to be. And there is another important benefit of not really worrying where the breath is being noted. As long as you know the breath is going in, the breath is going out, but you don't really know where it is going in and going out, it means you've let go a little bit more of body awareness. So the body can disappear more quickly. If you're focusing on the tip of the nose, you're focusing on the body, and you can't let go of bodily feelings. You'll have more aches and pains. You can't let go of the body that easy. But if you're just watching the breath wherever it happens to be, and not really caring where the breath is manifest, you just notice the breath is going in and going out, you don't know where, it means you've let go much more awareness of the body, and your meditation go very deep very quickly. Our body is very irritating, and the sooner we let it go so it disappears, the better. So this becomes the first two stages of Anapanasati. You just know the breath as it goes in, you know the breath as it goes out. Easy. Now what happens next is it gets so interesting. Your mindfulness gets stronger. Remember I said, I think at the beginning of this retreat, when you don't do so much, you have more energy can go into your mindfulness. So the mindfulness gets stronger. You can actually see more. I think I mentioned that with a simile of the mountain where I live on the first talk. As you go look through the window of a car, you can't see very much, you're going too fast. When you walk, you can see more. When you're absolutely still, you can see everything. So as you're going slower, because you're just watching your breath go in and go out, you can see much more of the breath. It's not just seeing in and out. You start to see the very beginning of an in-breath. It's that point when it just begins, and you see that feeling of the breath grow, grow, grow until it reaches its peak, its strongest point, and then it fades away again. I'm sure that everybody breathes pretty much the same. My breath, it takes, you know, quite a while, maybe about 70% of the time to reach its peak, and then it quite quickly fades away again, and then it stops. And then there's this beautiful pause between the breaths. You're not breathing in, and you haven't started to breathe out yet. And you're right there with your mind, you see the first flicker of the out-breath as it starts to go out again. And you see that that sensation too reaches its peak of intensity, and then that too falls away until you've completed the out-breath. And then there's another pause, a space where you're not breathing out and you haven't yet began to breathe in. And then you see the beginning of the in-breath again. You see so much of what's going on because your mindfulness has now got more power because of stillness. It happens naturally. Please don't force it. The trouble with talking about stages in Malaysia is you want to know, have I completed stage one? Can I now go on to stage two? You know, you're trying to get in control of this, and you're always trying to rush through, you know, to beat your friends, to see how quickly you can complete the course. So no, it is natural that after a while, quite naturally, you start to see more of the breath, you realize this is what's happening. And because your mind is becoming more full of breath awareness, there's no space in your awareness for other thoughts to come up. You find the experience of the breath blocks out all other sensations just about. You're just watching the breath as it just goes in and goes out. Yeah, you can sort of feel the body, but it's a long way away. You can hear sounds, but they're like a million miles away, because you're just right there, fascinated with the movement of the breath. In your walking meditation, a similar stage there is when you're moving your feet, and just the first sensation is your foot lifts up. You can feel that, you can feel all these other sensations. There's so much going on, and you just lifted your left foot, and you haven't even moved yet. And as you move forward, you can incredible number of sensations. You know how many muscles have to move for your foot to go up and down? Thousands of muscles. You start to feel all those different sensations. And it feels incredibly powerful, thrilling sensation when your foot meets the floor again. Wow. And this is what happens. You start to see many more of the things which are going on. You thought it was just in-breath, out-breath. It's not. It's an incredible amount of stuff going on there. That becomes the third stage of the meditation. Of the Anapanasati, sorry. That's where the full awareness of the body of breath, from the very beginning to the very end. Wow, that's fascinating. And then, number four, I've got to go quick. There's another 12 stages to go yet. Ah! Number four is when the breath starts to calm down. So what happens there? You don't calm it down and say, calm, 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 calm. If I tell you, sit still, you get more tense. Imagine your kid at night. And no, can't go to sleep at night. No, because he's uptight, he's just watched some sort of movie, a horror movie, or he's just played a tense video game. And he's sitting in bed and he can't go to sleep. So mummy comes into the room. And what does mummy do? You grab him by the throat and get the stick out. You better go to sleep, kid. You better go to sleep. If you don't get to sleep, you'll be in big trouble. Okay. Would that send your kid to sleep? Of course it would get even more tense. To calm your kid down, so go to sleep. Mummy comes into the room and she speaks so softly and strokes the kid's hair. There, everything is all right. Mummy is here. Shh. And your kid goes fast asleep. That's how you calm things down. Not through force, but through metta, through compassion. So that when you have the full awareness of the breath, be kind to your breath. And the breath will soften and become all oozy and calm and peaceful. But what happens when the breath calms down? This the fourth stage of Anapanasati, is that you cannot distinguish between the in-breath and the out-breath. They all feel the same. So you get this continuous awareness of the breath. And it becomes very peaceful and very beautiful. The fifth and sixth stages of Anapanasati are generating piti and sukha. This is the joy and happiness in meditation. This is what the Buddha told you to do, to be happy. So anyone who says, no, you're following the wrong path, you should tell them, well, what did the Buddha say in fifth, sixth stages of Anapanasati? He told us to generate that piti and sukha. So you follow what the Buddha said, not any monk or nun or teacher. Develop the happiness. Because that simile of the mount that I'm going up to the hill where my monastery lives, not only did I see more and more detail in that hillside, it started to look incredibly beautiful. And the greens were just so rich. And just everything you saw was absolutely beautiful. This is a stage which happens when your mindfulness gets strong. Not only do you see more, but everything you look at is incredibly lovely. And that's why when people really get into the meditation, they get into those stages when piti sukha starts to come up, you see them standing outside looking at a tree, just in awe of the beauty in a tree. Everything looks beautiful, even your lunch, and this is no exaggeration, your lunch tastes absolutely delicious. Literally, because your mindfulness is so strong, it can pick up many more flavors than the person sitting next to you. It happened once when I was meditating over in Perth. My mind was so strong, everything I looked at was so gorgeous, I was so happy, but I had to go to the toilet. And after doing my business in the toilet, I just happened to look in the toilet bowl. Wow, look at that! I've never seen such a beautiful piece of feces in my life. The browns, it's not just one brown, there's whole different shades of brown. And just the way it's formed, these beautiful shiny balls, because the water was glistening, you know, on the surface. And you wouldn't, it was like a work of art. It was something you should, you know, take into an art gallery. Just so incredibly beautiful. And I was looking at it for about 5 minutes, and somebody was waiting to go in the toilet, and it was such a great sacrifice to flush it down. That was so beautiful. How could I do that? Well, that's true. That happens. Simply because whatever you see when your mindfulness is strong is really, really gorgeous. Which is why that when you get to that stage, you're watching the breath, and it's a gorgeous breath. Just so beautiful and delightful, just watching this breath go in and go out. You're a happy person. Now that's the fifth and sixth stages. And I call that the pivot point, the tipping point of meditation. Because once you get to the happy meditations, then you're getting some idea of why you're meditating. This is not sort of a torture camp. It's not like going to the dentist. This is one of the most fun things you can ever do. And once you get into those happy meditations, then I've got you. You're going to meditate forever. Because you're enjoying it. It's so much fun. And you're going to increase the time of your meditations naturally. Half an hour is not enough. You're enjoying yourself too much. And it's those times when you get to those stages, the fifth and sixth stages, those are the times the bell goes for lunch. And you know there's no afternoon tea, there's no supper, there's nothing to eat until the following morning. You've got this choice. Come out of meditation and have lunch. Stay in meditation and have nothing to eat till the next day. And the meditation wins. You'd rather sit here and enjoy the peace than go and have something for lunch. Now that gives you an idea of how much happiness you're getting. It's really nice. And that's fifth and sixth stages. Just hear this beautiful happiness coming up in the meditation. You're breathing in, oh, it's just so nice. Breathing out, it's just beautiful. I call that the beautiful breath, but people said to me, beauty is actually what you see. It's much better to call it delightful breath. Because the breath is full of delight. It's a feeling, it's a sensation along with the breath. Because this stage of meditation, fifth and sixth, you're developing the Vedana, the feeling of the breath. And then that just gets even more subtle, it calms down. You just go to the, quite naturally, you don't do these things, it's just what happens as you meditate. As you feel the whole bodily sensation of the breath. And then number eight, you calm that down. So the beautiful feeling of the breath is what you're watching. Now you've generated it in fifth and sixth stage. This is the main thing you're watching in the breath. It's not so much in and out anymore. It's just delight, delight, delight. And you calm that down. And you calm that down until the breath disappears, which is stage number eight. You tranquilize that bodily sankhara. Pasambayang kaya sankhara. Number eight of the Anapanasati. This is where your breath disappears. It's gone. But if that goes before you develop the joy and happiness, that's where you go into a state where you don't really know where you are. It hasn't got enough energy and oomph to go further which is one of the big mistakes people make. They're so afraid of the happiness of meditation, they think something must be wrong, I'm enjoying myself, because they think the religion is supposed to be, you know, pain and asceticism and torture. But no, real religion is the happy place. So when you get into that stage of meditation, it's really beautiful and happy as you're meditating, and everything calms down until the breath disappears because of that happiness and that energy of the mind. The next thing which happens in Anapanasati, naturally, the ninth stage is you experience the nimitta. What they say is you're experiencing the citta, the mind. Six senses in Buddhism. The five senses have now been suppressed, transcended, they've gone. When a nimitta comes up, can't feel the body, can hardly hear sounds, smell, taste, sight, all closed down. So now you have the sixth sense in front of you. And for most people, they experience it as a beautiful light. Some of you go a bit fast, you're experiencing lights pretty early because you haven't gone through the happiness stage yet, which means you haven't done enough preparation to get the energy so strong that when that nimitta comes up, it's strong and beautiful. A beautiful light. Many meditators, I say this so that you don't keep asking questions in interview time, they come up to me and they say, I'm sure that it wasn't a nimitta. Someone was shining a flashlight in my face. It was the sun. I'm sure it was the sun. And I remind you, look, it's a cloudy day in KL. You can't see the sun. We don't have flashlights. There's no lights in front of your face. It was real. So when you see a light, this is from my personal experience as a teacher, 99% of the time it is a nimitta. It's a real one. Stop doubting it. It's real. But when it first comes up, it's just maybe a bit dull, maybe not last very long. But it's a sign that you're getting some in the meditation. Your five senses are disappearing. You're beginning to understand the nature of the mind. But with development, with more stillness, letting go, making peace, being gentle, not interfering with the process. What's happened there? You've put your cup down, you've let go long enough, it's still, and you get the first sign of nice stillness, this beautiful nimitta. What do? Is it still yet? Keep your hands off your mind. Stop interfering, for goodness sake, because things are happening. And there you are, you get a nice nimitta and you go and mess it up again. Leave it alone, for goodness sake. Because that's the reason why the nimitta vanishes. You get excited, you start to interfere. You can't leave anything alone. So when you leave it alone, the nimitta just grows and becomes more intense. And I know that somebody once, somebody said this in their interview time, said sometimes the nimitta is so bright they just can't stand it any longer. Brilliant, you can stand it. You're not seeing this with your physical eyes. This is just how the mind interprets them. That state. Because most people are visual people, you ask any psychologist, the part of your brain which deals with sight is so great, dominant, that in these mental images you just see it as if it was a visual image, a beautiful light. Number one, it doesn't matter what color it is. The colors are totally irrelevant. It could be blue, black, green, yellow, orange, gold, whatever, not important at all, as long as it's bright and beautiful. Sometimes people see these nimittas and they're spread around just like a white screen. Yeah, that's the beginning, but it's not really getting in there. You haven't got enough happiness yet, not enough preparation. When it really comes out like this beautiful light, like a moon, but brilliant, and it gets more and more brilliant. And don't worry, because you can take it, you don't go blind. You're seeing it through your mind. Just keep on going. Have fun. And the other thing is, the more intense it gets, the more intense pleasure you get, mental pleasure. And again, people start thinking, this can't be right, I'm really enjoying myself. You are supposed to enjoy yourself. Nibbana paramang sukhang. Nibbana is the ultimate happiness. So the closer you get to Nibbana, the happier you feel. And it's the case when you get into these nimitta stages, let alone what's going to come in next. Sometimes the happiness, sometimes you think you can't endure so much happiness. I like saying that because that used to be my experience. Sometimes I think no human being can take so much mental pleasure. It's just too great. But you can. Now you understand why I'm a monk. I have a great time in meditation. You just don't know how much pleasure there is in there. And it's something, as I said yesterday, it doesn't matter. The Buddha said, do not be afraid of that pleasure. Develop it, make much of it, follow it, because it leads to Nibbana. You're on the path. This is what's supposed to be happening. Read it in the suttas for yourself. So you become these really, really happy, blissed out meditators. And that's good, that's what's supposed to happen. So, the ninth stage is you experience this nimitta. The 10th and 11th stage is you work with this nimitta. Pasambayang Chittang is actually where you, I call it polishing up the nimitta, making it brighter and brighter. No, so Pasambayang. Oh no, that's, yes, right. That's where you calm it down so it gets brighter and brighter and brighter. And Samadhang Chittang is actually where you keep it still. The two problems there with the nimitta, it's moving around, so you have to keep it still and you have to get it more intense. It happens quite naturally if you leave it alone. But this is actually where you develop that nimitta to be totally still, to remain there for long periods of time and get really, really bright. And those are the really having great time in meditation. That's where, you know, no way that someone can disturb you. You know, it's like when your husband may be watching the TV, maybe watching a, you know, English Premier League soccer match. There's only 5 minutes to go and it's a draw and he's really wondering who's going to win. And you ask him, say, darling, your supper's ready. But he doesn't hear you. It's not he's ignoring you. Look, he just, you know, his sense of hearing is totally cut off because he's totally absorbed in the TV set for the soccer match. So don't get angry at him. He's just in the sort of jhana, what we call soccer jhana. But that you can sort of understand what happens when you've got this incredibly beautiful nimitta inside of you. There's no way you can attend to sound. It's just not important anymore. So your sense of seclusion from the world is really getting cut off. And when that nimitta is bright enough and beautiful enough, you just merge into it. And that's where we call Rinpocheyang Chittang. You totally free the mind once and for all. Well, not once and for all, but for many, many minutes or hours from the five sense world. You get into the jhanas. Incredible, powerful states of mind. Where you're totally still. Well, not totally still in the first jhana, second jhana above. Absolutely still. Nothing is moving at all. And you can't do anything. So your sense of self, the one in control, the one who is writing all these notes down, the one who's sort of scratching their waist, the ones moving their leg, all that sort of stuff, putting on your glasses, you can't do anything, you're absolutely stuck. You've disappeared, baby, you've gone. And instead you're in incredible bliss and peace. And this is actually where you start understanding what the nature of the mind truly is. This is where you get great insights, or rather where you get the data of insights. You have experiences which most people don't even think could happen. And there you are, experiencing this for many hours. Blissed out in deep state of stillness. Many things have disappeared. Not only are these great states of meditation, this is actually where the Buddha went before he became enlightened. It's where he abode. In places like the Gopakamogalana Sutta. Somebody asked Ananda just after the Buddha had passed away, because Ananda was the go-to monk at that time, and they asked Ananda, what type of meditation did the Buddha recommend? And Ananda replied, the Buddha only recommended four types of meditation. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. This is the explanation again and again and again, consistently without any deviation, when the Buddha said Samma Samadhi, the eighth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, Sama Samadhi is always first, second, third, or fourth jhana. This is what Samadhi is. Not concentration, because concentration is the wrong word. These words have been translated into English, starting off with this Professor Rice Davis about 130, 40, 50 years ago. He did a very good job. Some of his translations were brilliant, like mindfulness for sati. He should have a medal for that translation. It was perfect. But when he translated concentration for this word samadhi, that was not so good. It would be much better to call it stillness. Perfect stillness. Samadhi. And this is actually what you're experiencing. The great stillness of the mind. And the bliss which comes from that stillness. And the insight which comes from understanding what it is like to be perfectly still. And what has disappeared. And why it is so blissful. But that is a subject of another talk. Because now I've just told you how to get into those jhanas. Sometimes it just happens naturally. Please don't strive to get into a jhana. How can you strive and be still? The way to get into a jhana, I've told you already several times. Press the letting go button. Put things down. Renounce. Be kind. Allow things to be. And if you can stay like that long enough, you'll find it's the nature of your mind to get more and more still as less things move. You find you just go through all these stages naturally, perfectly. Present moment awareness, still silence, just watch the breath. Keep watching the breath, you start to see more of the breath naturally. The breath becomes very delightful. The breath disappears. You get this wonderful happiness. The nimitta appears. You just brighten up that nimitta because you're doing nothing, it just happens by itself. You get incredibly blissed out, and as long as you don't get excited or afraid, as long as you don't interfere, you just fall into these jhanas. People have done these who've never had any instructions, simply because they've just let go, and this is just what happened. So that's what Anapanasati, the 12 steps of Anapanasati. The next four steps are about insight, and maybe I'll do those tomorrow. So, any questions about the breath meditation technique? And as you noticed, I hope, I spent most of this talk on the beginning stages, because the preparation is the most important. Don't rush too fast. You get the preparation really, really, really strong. Everything else falls together very quickly. So any questions about... Yes?
So these state of happiness, are we in the state of subconscious or still conscious?
Very conscious. Very aware. Super conscious. You know what the word Buddha means? Buddha comes from the verb bujati, which means to awake. And Buddha, instead of calling it enlightened one, according to the Pali in the Sanskrit, it's more accurate to call it awakened one. Because you'll understand when you get into these powerful mindfulness states that you are waking up. You're half asleep right now. But you think you're awake because this is the best you know. So what you take is fully awake. When you get into these jhanas, is being three quarters asleep. You're fully aware, really conscious, totally awake for maybe the first time in your life. And you realize just how much in life you're in this dullness called delusion. Hardly awake at all, but you're so used to it you think that this is wakefulness. So you wake up, the mindfulness gets incredibly strong. You are, for the first time, fully conscious, really awake. And afterwards you go back to sleep again as you come out of the jhanas. But at least you know what it's like to be bujati, awake. So it's fully conscious. Does that answer your question? I think so. Yes. Who's the first one getting up? No. Come on. Okay, he's getting a piece of paper. Are they in red? Sure, yes. And then afterwards the girl behind. Yeah. Okay, yeah, sure. If you say to study meditation, can she put on these eye masks so that she doesn't have to see shades? Because it's true that when you close your eyes, sometimes when you first meditate, you get, it's a bit interested what's going on outside, so you just take a peek. And when you have the eye shades on, you can't even take a peek, so it does actually help keep the eyes from being interested in the outside world. And also because sometimes someone turns a light on and sometimes turns a light off, it means that you can actually see that through your eyelids. So yeah, fine, if you want to use the eye mask, fine. So just you can put that on. No trouble at all. So the girl at the back behind you. Okay, when someone is dying, close to death, and how can you help them meditate? They may be sort of half conscious or in a coma, and can you as a meditator help them? Look, sometimes it's like people come up to me and they're just going to have an exam tomorrow morning and they ask me to do some chanting. Because they're very scared. It's a bit late, when you're on your deathbed. It's much obviously better to learn meditation earlier before you die. And on that subject, those of you, maybe a few people here have had near-death experiences, you've died and you've floated out of your body. If you haven't had a personal experience of that, you've certainly heard of so many other people who've had that experience. You maybe see documentaries on the TV about it. What happens after you float out of your body? You go towards the light. What's going on there? It means your five senses, when you're dead, are stopped and you go towards the light. That is exactly the same as a nimitta. That nimitta which you see in meditation, when your five senses are almost cut off, is exactly the same you see when you die. Because your mind is still going on after you die. And so you might say this type of meditation is a training on how to die properly next time. You know what's going to happen because you let your five senses go in meditation, just like your five senses are forced to stop at death. So that's happening. If the person hasn't meditated before, all you can do as a loved one is just keep reminding them to let go. Don't struggle. Stop trying. Use your wisdom power, not willpower, from now on. And if you keep telling them to let go, let go, let go of everything. Please let go of your family. We give you permission to die. Let go of all your possessions. You can't take anything with you. Leave them all alone. And please let go of just any guilt you may have for things you've done. Let go of any anger. Please let this world go. And let go of your senses as well. So if you can encourage people just to let go, you're encouraging them to do what is important for meditation. You're not telling them how to meditate. You're telling them to please, just make peace, be kind, be gentle with this process. And then meditation will happen. That's the best you can do. Okay. When nimitta light gets dimmer, what does it mean? What wrong have we done? Yeah, it is because you've interfered. It means that the light has come up and you've got either excited or afraid. You've lost your stillness. You've wasted the energy. So it's if you've got a light bulb and it gets dimmer and dimmer, it means somebody else is taking the energy somewhere else. So there's not enough energy to keep the light going. So you're actually taking the energy away from the light, the nimitta. which means you're doing something, you're controlling, you're hoping, you're expecting. One of the dangers of me teaching like this, and one thing I should point out to you, it's great talking about jhanas and talking about how blissful they are, but the downside is that now you'll crave them like anything. I want these jhanas. Ajahn Brahma has given such a great job of describing them. They're so blissful, they're close to nirvana. I want. And that is now going to cause you a lot of frustration. You can't get these things by wanting them. This is what happens when you stop all wanting. So please get out of the way. Let go. Renounce your controller. You just be the passenger. Be passive. Don't make things happen. Leave them alone. If it gets, the light gets dim, you've lost the plot. You're getting involved again. You've taken charge of the process. That's why it gets dim. You find if you totally let go, okay, if nimitta comes, it comes, it goes, it goes. No, to hell with all of this. I'm just going to be still. Then the nimitta gets very strong. But if you get involved, interfere, the energy is gone. It's like, you fill the bathtub with water and you've gone and pulled the plug out. So it all goes down the plug hole. So keep the plug in the hole. Don't do anything. And let the energy keep building, building, building. And you get incredibly powerful nimittas. This is actually real dinky dai, brilliant, beautiful, blissful meditation. If you get into something like that, you go home. You'll have all your friends and your office workers coming to the next retreat. They say, gee, what have you been on that retreat with Ajahn Brahm? You're so blissed out. Whatever it was, I want some of that. Bliss beyond your wildest dreams. That's something. And that's the reason I talk like this, is because knowing what I'm talking about, I want you to experience that too. It's very nice as a teacher when somebody gets into the jhanas for the first time. I just love those interviews where people come up to you and they just got a really, really nice meditation. Because you know what it's like? The nearest I could explain is when, maybe your daughter or your son has just fallen in love. They found this incredibly wonderful boy and they come up to you, your mummy and daddy, say, "Mummy, he's so beautiful, I'm in love, he's so wonderful, oh." I don't know if you've ever been in love for the first time. You're just totally blissed out. You're in another world. It's quite cute to see someone when they first fall in love. If you see them, they're just so happy and there's no problem or pain or difficulty in the whole of the world because they're in love. Now you have to fight that a couple of times and you understand what it's like when you're in the jhana. Or you come out afterwards. Oh, it's so wonderful. It's so beautiful. Oh, everything is nice. So that's what it's like. A really big happiness, a big boost. When I see that, I really like, good. Someone's getting somewhere. Wow, lots of questions now. Okay, 1, 2, 3, and then we're finished, and then we'll actually... Because if we spend all the time talking about and asking questions, you'll never get into jhanas. Okay, just the girl there. Yes? Okay, so the light in jhana nimitta is similar to the light which you see when you die, but in the meditation that you voluntarily let go of the five senses temporarily, in death they're taken away from you for physical reasons. So when you go into the nimittas and into the jhanas, you always come out again afterwards. You don't die. So you'll come out, but you'll come out just a beautiful woman. Change, understanding, a very, very deep dharma, and very, very powerful, the most powerful experience of your whole life. So it's very well worthwhile doing, and it's not dangerous. Quite the opposite. There is just one possible side effect to getting the jhanas, and that is you may lose your hair. Yes, that's the question. But not everyone loses their hair.
How does insight arise from this jhana stage?
can you wait till tomorrow to answer that question? Because that's a whole talk, and I'd love to do that tomorrow. How the jhana leads to the deep insights. And there's one question, what is it from over here? Oh, yes.
Just you mentioned not enough preparation.
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, not preparation. It's like, you know, you want to go on a journey in your car. Before you go on a journey, say you're travelling to Singapore, or you're going, maybe driving all the way up to Bangkok, which you can do. Now, what would you do with your car? You take it for a service, you check the oil, you check the brake fluids, everything you check, because it's a long journey. If you don't do that preparation, you're liable to sort of break down halfway, and that's really big trouble. So the preparation is really important. So when you're preparing in meditation, especially the very beginning, present moment awareness, silence. Another preparation is getting a nice posture, so that when you sit down, you don't just sit yourself down on the mat and think that that's all you have to do. I usually spend 1 or 2 minutes adjusting my posture to make sure I'm really going to be comfortable. If I'm going to sit for a long time, I really need to be sort of comfortable. If this is not right, I'm going to move again. And so I really look after my posture before I do some nice meditation. Now just make sure you've gone to the toilet, you've washed, or whatever else you need to do. Don't just think that you just sit down and meditate and everything will be okay. Sometimes that's what happens. You get aches and pains, you have to go to the toilet, you know, because you haven't really prepared properly. So when the preparation is there, your body lets you be free for long enough to get into these nice meditations. Present moment awareness and silence, because those are the main obstacles. Wandering off into the past or future, or wandering off into all this thinking world. Address the main problems, first of all, to weaken them, and then when you meditate, it's easy. You can watch the breath without much force. Does that answer the question? No, not really. Yeah.
Okay, but how do you do, you sit the past, the present, you weaken it?
You weaken it by spending a lot of time with your main focus on just being present. And every time a thought of the past comes up, no, not now. Every time a thought of the future and the plan, the fear comes up, remember, now is the place my future is being made. If I care about my future, I've got to care about now. So that you forget about all those plans. So one moment at a time. Just deal with this present moment, and all the other moments in the future will look after themselves.
So you mentioned the pain from posture.
Yeah.
So once we hit the pain and it doesn't go away,
move.
We just switch posture.
Switch.
Don't study the pain.
Don't study the pain. Because it's an important thing, because especially for new meditators, if you start to experience pain and you think you have to bear with the pain, this will be the last retreat you'll ever come on. It's just too painful. And people get the idea, and many people in Malaysia get this idea. The meditation is only for the tough guys and tough girls. You have to really enjoy meditation retreats. And so most people say, I don't want to meditate because I hear it hurts. And so when meditation becomes comfortable, you get many more people coming to learn meditation, and they get far greater results, and the benefits of meditation get spread far and wide. So please move. Okay, so that's it, folks, for this morning's talk. And again, I promise tomorrow's talk will be on insight and how this jhana leads to incredible deep insights, the insights which are going to change your whole life. Not only this life, but all your lives, to make this your very last. Coming soon in a temple near you. Tomorrow.